I have no idea how a sitcom is created. So we asked the crew of Murphy Brown, the top 10 comedy about an unconventional Washington journalist, to let us track one episode from the original idea to the final applause.
Ready graphics? Ready theme?
Hi, I'm Jesse Mullins.
And I'm Lauren Milberger.
And this is FYI,
the Murphy Brown podcast.
She's just so delighted.
And they laugh.
And it's just great to see professionals at work.
Damn misogyny. Ruins the party again.
Startled the beast. And on today's episode,
we'll be talking about season 3, episode 5, Bob and Murphy and Ted and Avery,
part 2.
We are entering a, I would say, what is implied to be a somewhat seedy pool hall.
Yes.
This is what I have written. Before the siren outside, indicating a shady neighborhood, is over, we must stop here and immediately discuss the outfit of Ms. Murphy Brown entering the door. I mean, it's, you don't even have a breath before you're like, boom, outfit. Would you like to discuss, Lauren, the choice made for this outfit?
Yes. So in the document, I keep calling it a documentary. So in the Primetime Live episode, we see Candace picking out her clothes with in the costume vault. And she said that she wanted to pick this particular outfit because it made her feel like a toreador. And then she felt that Murphy was sort of ready for a bullfight, that she sees this date and she's very excited.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to explain this outfit, but it is black with these bejeweled sort of beaded things. I totally see how Candace saw it as sort of a toreador outfit. It has a short skirt and knee-high boots that match.
I would say nearly thigh-high. Nearly thigh-high.
These,
like over the knee.
This is an outfit.
Let me tell you, this outfit would hit so hard today. Like if someone wore this on TikTok, it would slap. Like people would be so excited.
It's fantastic. But it also shows how out of place Murphy is in this bar.
One of these things is not like the others.
It
like
is not.
Even the rest of the group, the men in their suits and Avery in her bowler cap and coordinated outfit, even they fit in better in this pool hall than Murphy does.
Her entrance gets a laugh line because it's just, yeah, no.
It's incredible. Yeah,
Murphy is raring to go.
Well, in the process of entering and seeing the surroundings, Murphy is asking Avery if she's sure because Murphy feels a little overdressed. Avery is looking around just hungrily, saying she knew she'd like it the minute she set her eyes on it. It smells dangerous.
She's just so delighted.
Yes, and I love this. In a sitcom today, setting up them entering a seedy pool hall that might smell dangerous to these women, I think would look even seedier. But I do love the idea that, like, this is seedy for Avery.
Yes, it's very like white,
you know?
Rich white lady privilege. Like, oh,
yeah.
Look
it's
at
just
this.
A working class bar.
It's a working class bar. How delightful. Let's play.
It's not much more working class than Phil's.
Although I do feel that they're implying it's a biker bar, right?
Exactly. That's the thing. Well, and the sirens outside, like they're implying that it is rougher. They're in a rougher neighborhood.
Yeah.
With the siren outside and all that kind of stuff. But the men inside, even like they're four bikers, they're very put together.
Yeah.
This also reminds me of in Sister Act when they go into the biker bar across the street.
Yes.
And when you look at it with today's lenses, you're like, oh, it's not that bad. It's just a bunch of people, which is part of the joke as well. Part of the joke is like, these are just normal people living their lives. They're just not upper crust. But I think also there is, it's a little more sanitized compared to what we would see now.
Agreed.
Simply because of the style of the time. It's not a judgment on like that it wasn't dressed well or something like that. It's just a if we filmed this today, they would have to make it look seedier.
I also think that this would be the kind of set that you would see on Roseanne.
Exactly.
And nothing
it's
would be thought
time.
Of it. It just would have been a bar where Roseanne and her sister went to have a drink.
Yep. I'm always fascinated by these things. The way that we, during a particular era of entertainment, some of the styling tropes of sets and environments to tell a certain story. And the styling of this bar to be the smells dangerous working class, potentially biker pool hall is different than how we would sell it now because of the set dressing styling of the time is all I'm saying.
I think also with the fact that the next line from Theodore is like, oh, there was this lovely ice cream shop with antique fans, that this is the kind of place that Murphy and Avery have no problem with, whereas Ted or Theodore is a little uneasy.
Sure. I think what actually matters to me the most is the idea that this bar doesn't seem to fit into the same neighborhood as what Theodore mentions they just passed. How far away was that cute little ice cream? Like, how far into a neighborhood that that Theodore would never enter?
Yeah.
Possibly just because it's normal people who pay their bills. But, like, how far into the depths of the underworld does Theodore think that they've traveled? And how far away was this ice cream? Like, I feel like this ice cream store was actually a couple miles away.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this is a man who during the day hangs out at a museum.
But this is met by Avery saying, "I want to stay, Theodore," with this like little pout. And then she again caresses his lapel and she pouts at him. And I cannot. I feel so intrusive. If I was her daughter, I'd be like, "Mom," which is basically what Murphy is doing. So Bob tells his dad to come with him to go get drinks and pretzels. And then he cracks a joke to Murphy about if anyone gives them trouble, tell them they're with that big guy over there. And they laugh. They're having a great time. And Murphy turns back and says, "He's so great, Mother. You're absolutely right. Sometimes you just have to jump in with both feet." Avery starts walking over to grab some pool cues, or as we hear her later say, pool poles. Wants to give her a little advice to try to act like a lady.
Mm.
I was told that once, but not by my family.
Oof.
She says, "Men don't like women that are too aggressive or know more than they do or open their own car doors. It's a known fact." And I remember watching this, and even though I know what happens, I remember being like, "You don't agree with this, Avery. Like, you're absolutely saying the like how it should be, but you don't actually agree with this." But it's amazing watching this woman who is just at her core the antithesis of these things, still upholding this system.
Yeah, and then what we see by the end of the scene is that not only does she not believe in it, she is lessening herself. She is changing who she is.
Yep.
To make this man like her because she feels that that's what she has to do and that's what she's done
and
her whole life.
I mean, honestly, to her credit, that is what she would need to do to get Theodore, to get a man of his generation and his type. Like, she's not wrong, but it's whether or not she wants it. And she's convinced herself because of this conversation earlier in the episode with Murphy that that is what she needs and wants at this time. And it's wonderful to see her come to this place of like, "No, I don't." It's a tale as old as time. Murphy tells her mother that she's stuck in another generation. Bob's a man of the 90s. He's not threatened by a competent woman. Avery very confidently says, "If you want to see how to impress men, watch your mother." Which, again, even though she's wrong, she's also not wrong. She is very good at what she's doing.
Yes, she is.
The men return. They have beer, soda, and plenty of pretzels. Avery announces that they grabbed four poles, one for each of us. It's so rigid and static and just... the way this woman plays like she doesn't know what she's talking about.
Yeah. Oh, poo. Oh, little old me.
To achieve her, it's like, if you have seen Avery before, you know this has to be a lie. But she's so convincing that it makes you wonder if she's not. It's expert.
You know what it is?
Of course.
It's the Barbie movie.
It's the Barbie movie. So Theodore begins teaching her about pool, and she does this. I can't even recreate it, but just the way she simpers, "Theodore, you know so much about this," to Murphy in the background, just rolling her eyes. It's incredible. They do so many good two shots in this scene. Bob, it says, "Wonderful, let's do teams, two against two." Murphy says, in a complete opposition to her mother, that that's a great idea, but warns him that she's not a novice, having played with the crew on the road. Bob, very confidently, very turned on by this at this point, things will change, says he was unbeaten 4 years at Yale. They decide that's probably not fair for the two of them to be partners, so they'll do boys against girls. He offers, "How about eight ball?" Murphy's, "Eight ball? Eight ball is for amateurs. Now nine ball, that's a game of skill." And she does this thing with her hands out in front of her
and just says,
"You need the hands of a surgeon for nine ball."
Elegant fingers. She has the most elegant fingers. I love Candace Bergen is a wonderful comedic actress, but she also has such a great physicality with her body. And this is such a great example of it. Just the way that she, it's great.
The way she like twiddles her fingers in front of her saying you need to have the hands of a surgeon for nine ball.
Yeah.
And then of course, Avery just smacks her. It would have been an elbow, but it's much better that it's a smack.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "Unless you'd really like to play eight ball, that would be fine with me." Bob says, "No, nine ball is fine, but let's make it more interesting. They have to call their shots." Murphy's thrilled by this. Theodore, being a gentleman of his time, insists that the ladies go first. And Murphy goes to break. And what I love is there is this fun camera snap to the break and snap back to her triumphant close-up when she has an excellent break. It's such a quick change of pace cinematically that doesn't normally happen. That it's like snap, snap. And they do it again later. Yeah. But it's such a fun little thing every once in a while in some of these episodes to see them playing with different camera technique.
Yeah. And something that they mention in the behind the scenes is that this scene was filmed mm-hmm. before the audience came in. And so they were able to probably have more latitude in that with the camera angles.
Well, and I am curious about it because they say in the behind the scenes that they filmed the most difficult scene first and they show them in the pool hall, except this parts of this scene do have the audience because there's a moment with a very specific audience response that I wonder if they filmed the majority of it with the playing, but kept some of the scene with the audience because there's a montage that comes up that clearly does not need the audience that I think is the majority of what they filmed.
Oh, that's a good question. I assumed that they played the footage for the audience.
I'd be curious because there is a, they have some very specific pauses that seem to be in response to audience reaction in when they're standing and talking and not necessarily playing. I wouldn't be surprised if they filmed the whole scene and the montage and got those really, because the montage is really difficult. There are some really difficult hits.
That's a good point, you know, and obviously because,
and I wonder if they yeah. went back and did some of just like the talking and kind of marked some of the playing in this scene, because specifically there's a moment with her with an Avery line that is so held for audience. I'd be surprised if that wasn't played to an audience.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So I digress. Bob is suitably impressed by the break and she says, "Step aside, gentlemen, deuce in the corner pocket." It does. She does the best. Yes. Who is she?
I love her in this scene.
Also, her and Bob, like, kudos to John Getz. He meets her as far as, like, the celebratory arrogance in this first section. Yeah. They're both obnoxious. And which, in another world, would have been perfect.
Yeah.
Because they're so equally matched.
Like, you see, if this scenario had not happened, mm-hmm. that they probably would have dated for a bit.
Damn misogyny. Yeah. Ruins the party again. She struts around the table, intent to dominate. Bob says he likes it that she doesn't feel the need to let a man win to boost his ego. What I love is when he says, you know, Murphy, what one of the things I like about you is that you don't feel the need to let a man win to boost his ego. The second he says that, I just write, danger. Mm-hmm. Like, you're like, oh no, yeah. This is coming from a man who absolutely wants his ego boosted.
And then he's like, so happy when she messes up too.
The second a line like that happens, you know it's not honest.
Yeah.
And what's even better is that she's not even listening to him as she's strutting around and doing this. Three in the side pocket. And he's saying, no, I mean, it's great that men and women have gotten to the point where they don't have to be threatened by each other. We get another snap cut to her missing the three in the pocket. And he immediately, without a beat, goes, ha, you missed. Okay, buddy. Okay. Murphy is clearly not amused. What I like is it's not the turn to dislike of him. It's not amused in a competitive way.
Mm-hmm.
She's like grumpy that she missed.
Excuse me, yeah.
Which is very different than later when she's over him.
Yeah.
Now he gets some swagger. He says he guesses it's his turn. So then he says three in the corner makes it. Theodore with a in the background with a that's my boy. And his version of the Murphy line is looky, looky, looky. And he does this dance strut past and behind Theodore and Avery that is truly hilarious. Like, I assume at this time that John Getz probably had to audition for this role, if not just being offered because he had enough of a career at this time. But it's such a significant guest star that I feel like they probably did audition it. If he had done this in the audition, that's how he got it. Like, he goes from being so straight-laced and interesting and normal to just this clown car. It's incredible.
Yeah, and later when he does this sort of, like, little Ninja Turtle thing with the pool cues, this is great.
Yep. It's, oh my gosh, he's so funny. What I like is this is the first time we don't snap to the loss. We just stay on a two-shot of Murphy leaning to watch his hit and him making the hit or making the shot. And we find out that it doesn't work from Murphy just smiling, going, aww. Then we see a delicate male ego start to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
Bob's response to this is, well, that's not fair. Somebody coughed. And this table's not level. It should have gone in. Murphy goes, shoulda, woulda, coulda. Give us some room. It's my mother's shot. What I like is that Avery's standing there holding her pool cue vertical. As Murphy's talking to her, she just starts putting more chalk on her mother's pool cue.
Mm-hmm.
And Avery asks, are we winning? Murphy says, yes, mother. Now you just have to get that purple ball into that pocket over there. You don't have to hit it hard. And I do, I just want to call out what I think is a wonderful bit of direction and writing, which is that unlike Theodore, who, now granted, this is part of the mating ritual as well, but Theodore like actively shows her how to hit the ball and like really teaches her, like she's never touched this before. Murphy's just like, yep, you just have to get it in there. You don't have to hit it too hard, and leaves her to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like there's something about the like, you can do it. Just hit it. However, thank goodness Theodore is there to show Avery how to pool. How to pool?
How to pool. I like that.
Luckily, sure. Y'all, I'm terrible at pool. So like the fact that I know any jargon is amazing. So he, of course, does the traditional, gets behind her, shows how to make the shot, says she just has to let it slide right through her fingers. Shockingly, Avery does not succeed. It is not a smooth slide through the fingers. And we get my favorite little line, which is, oh, poo. It's such a line that, like, if Corky was of that time, Corky would say, oh, poo.
Yeah.
But it's so not an, you know, Avery doesn't say, oh, poo in real life. No, Avery swears.
Yeah, she's putting on an act for this guy.
It's incredible. Theodore, of course, is consoling her and says she was very close, wasn't she, Bob? And Bob simpers back, oh, yes, she was very close. Murphy says, they're patronizing us, Mother. It's a cover. You know why? Because they're scared. Unfortunately, we cut to later in the evening. Time has passed, and Avery and Murphy are just sitting sullenly at the high tops at the bar, watching as the men are standing at the table. Bob makes a particularly good shot, begins cheering and posturing and flipping the pool cue around like it's a staff.
They're so obnoxious.
It's obnoxious. He says, well, ladies, looks like you're about to lose your fifth game. Or was it sixth? I've lost track. He then gestures over Murphy's hair, being like, what are these, cobwebs? He giggles and walks away. He asks if he could get them something to read while they wait their turn. Maybe War and Peace. It's so gross. Murphy says she hates this to Avery. She says the brown women are being humiliated. She's handling it so well. Murphy doesn't know how she does it. And then she says, well, she wishes she could follow her lead. After all, it is just a game. Unfortunately, Papa Theodore misses his next shot. He says, ouch. Well, all good things must end. Bob says, don't worry, it's not for long. It's your turn, Avery. And the way they smile at her, the way she stiffens, the rigidity of Colleen Dewhurst. Like, this moment is so Marilla Cuthbert. Also, for anyone who is wondering, we have a loving deep dive into Colleen Dewhurst's career in her first entrance in the show in season one in Mama Said. Please go listen to it because we are massive fans. My love of Colleen Dewhurst is Avery Brown and Marilla Cuthbert. And this particular posture is so Marilla Cuthbert. She is, oh, do not mess with this woman. And they do not realize. I don't know how they don't realize, because again, her stare could sterilize a man, but they don't realize because they're so in their own machismo. Theodore, you know, helpfully offers, don't worry, honey. Nobody expects too much from you. Remember, this is a man's game. It's in our genes.
And there it is.
And the men laugh. And we all know they're going to die now.
that was the, like, if he had just not said that, he wouldn't have startled the beast.
Oh, he poked the dragon. She was sleeping. It has risen. And what I like is, again, to the brilliance of this casting, she and Candace Bergen are making the exact same face.
They look Avery very and much Murphy alike.
Look so similar.
We didn't,
and they are making the same face.
I mean, we didn't talk about this as much in Mama Said, but like you look at young pictures of Colleen Dewhurst and you're like, oh, well, this is probably the only name that they thought of. Like she's it's not just her demeanor and her stage persona.
It's her nose.
Yes. She looks,
oh my gosh,
just like Candace Bergen. It's perfect
they
casting.
They look so much like mother-daughter in this moment, because now at this, like, this is one of those moments where they lock in and it is the same demeanor, the same face. It's chilling if you know them. So Avery rises and says, what an interesting theory. She approaches the table, gets into position, says, you two gentlemen will want to find chairs and sit in them. I may be here for a while. What I love is the men don't realize yet that they've been, what's the term, sharked? Is it sharking?
Yeah. Or she's a ringer.
The gentlemen don't realize what's about to happen to them. But what I like is the rest of the room seems to notice a change in the air. So the gentlemen just look playfully shocked. What I love is she says this line and the audience starts to lose it.
Yeah.
And someone in the audience just goes, yeah! It's like there's a yeah in the audience that makes me so happy. I was like, that person is me. I've time traveled back in time, and I am that person in the audience.
The audience is Murphy and Avery having to sit through that display of them.
And we've
being...
been waiting. We've been praying that she is a ringer. Like, we've just been praying that we were right about her the whole time.
It's, you're not expecting it if you don't know what's going to happen. And it's so glorious because of the humiliation that these men are making them go through.
Well, and she's just... It's just the perfect comeback. It's the perfect moment because she is so in control. She is so far from hysterical, and anything that a man could like gender toward a woman as far as being upset. She was just laying in wait, and now it's time. And they are being taken down the exact way that they would. And it is so satisfying. So she says, 8 in the corner pocket. It goes in. And Bob says, lucky shot. She goes, luck my ass.
Ugh.
9 in the side. 9 goes in. Everyone in the bar has leaned forward to watch. Murphy walks over to her mother and says, what are you doing? How are you doing it? And she says one of my favorite lines, which is, you remember your father's pool table? Well, if it's 1952 and your husband doesn't want you to have a career and you're at home with a child, you find something to amuse you. This was mine.
I love the way she goes, this was mine. It's just...
This was mine.
The register. She always knows how to, like, even though her voice already has a low register.
She knows.
She knows how to just lower...
Drop it.
And something on what you were saying before, I think that the calmness of Avery is an example of a trait that Murphy did not get, right?
Yep.
The assumption is that the temper that Murphy has is probably from Bill.
Yep.
But the way that she, her bluntness and the way that she does interact with people is very close to her mother. She just does not have this sort of sereneness that Avery is able to hold in.
Murphy doesn't know how to wait to strike.
Mm.
And that's what I think is so great about the Murphy's line of, what are you doing? How are you doing it? Because she does not recognize the art of this.
And does not recognize that in her own mother. It's like she's seeing a totally different person.
About?
Like, it's not just that.
Which I find so fascinating that we all are not surprised that she had this in her and her own daughter is.
But I think it makes sense. I mean, in the sense of how, you know, many times you don't get to see your parents as full adults.
Yeah.
But, and also the fact that, like, she's sat and watched her mother, just like these two gentlemen, be very bad at this game, right? It's that she doesn't see
her mother is such a good actress. She tricked her as well.
Yeah. And I think also it goes back to something that we've talked about before with Frank, with even with Mama Said, is not seeing your parents as adults. And so this is a side of her mother she has just never seen, let alone not seen tonight.
Well, and especially this idea of, like, this is probably what Avery did whenever Murphy was napping. You know, like, this is what Avery did for herself when she was finally able to be alone. So this was not done around Murphy. This was not learned. This was Avery's special place. And I also think about in terms of course, Murphy doesn't see it because when you grow up with your parents, you see them as parents. You see this, you have your lived experience, which centers yourself. What we've gotten is, you know, that kind of, we've gotten a cultivated Avery Brown as viewers. We get to see Avery Brown now, not Avery Brown before. We don't have that lived experience with her as our mother, but we've also gotten to see these highlights of her that are cultivated from seeing her as a guest star. So we're all like, oh yeah, it's coming. And Murphy's like, what's coming? What are you talking about? That's what's great about Avery. That's what's great about Murphy as Avery's daughter is that they are excellent in ways that no one ever considered their gender could be.
Yeah, and that she and her mother have more in common than she realized. It's beautiful.
So then I wrote, and then we have a montage of Avery Brown, the first of her name, the mother of Murphy, the breaker of balls and misogyny, and her daughter destroying these men at pool. It's a montage. Many things happen. There is a great moment where she blows on the end of a cue like a smoking gun. There's this incredible shot where she smiles back at them over her shoulder and winks as she makes a shot. I have to know, do we think she actually, we'll jump ahead and talk about this in the behind the scenes, but specifically this shot, do we think that she actually makes this shot or did they cheat the camera so someone else makes the shot for her so she can pose there and wink on cue and not worry about making it?
Oh, they cheated the camera.
Yes. I mean, because the stiffness of that shot, if Colleen Dewhurst made that shot, it would be a full body Like, we would see her make it. It is cheated in such a way that her hand is just holding and she's smiling and winking. It looks, they had to have cheated the shot.
Also, how bad she is when they're teaching Colleen Dewhurst how to play pool.
There's no way Colleen Dewhurst learned how to do this. Like, when we get to the behind the scenes, you'll understand what we're talking about. She's so bad. And she's, I feel really that in bad. My soul, because yeah. I'm so bad at this. She Anywho, can't. So the montage shows that the men are going to suffer. Okay, so let's talk about this montage and the song connected to it. The song Everybody Needs Somebody to Love is a song originally written by Burt Burns, Solomon Burke, and Jerry Wexler, and originally recorded by Solomon Burke under the production of Burns at Atlantic Records. Yeah, now you may think that's a lot of names, and that's going to cause a little confusion about who wrote what. You'd be right. And that does fall into some issues behind the release of this song originally.
Oh, interesting.
Burke recalled in an interview in 1997, he said, quote, "When I did it for Jerry Wexler and Burt Burns, they told me that song would never make it. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a piece of it. They said, that's the way we'll get the record played, so we'll take a piece of it. In those days, they took a piece of your songs, a piece of the publishing, but in the end, you didn't have any pieces left. Even now, oh. I'm still struggling to get the publishing, the royalties, and that'll never happen." So this was released in 1964. That was in 1997.
Wow.
When he said that. So all that to say, you have a lot of people working on songs like this, especially during this time where these larger labels own everything. Trying to get your cut when you're sharing credits can be very complicated. Now, the actual song itself, I don't know if this is the same interview, but in an interview, Burke recalled that the origins came from doing this song and a version of the song as a kid in church. And it was a march for the offering in church. He said, "We would play it with tubas, trombones, and the big bass drum, and it sounded really joyful. I played it to Jerry Wexler and Burt Burns, who thought it was too fast and it had the wrong tempo. So then they started messing with it and pulling it back a little bit, but trying to keep this kind of preacher speaking to the people element to it, but pulling it back a bit," which I think is really beautiful in the way that we take inspiration, especially culturally, from where we grew up and yeah. where music was first introduced.
You know, I find it so fascinating because you hear other stories about how all they did was change the tempo
yeah.
or, you know, do a small thing to it. And it's the same song, but it sounds completely different. And you're mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, one, it's either adding in an instrument, taking out an instrument, slowing the tempo down, a different type of voice. This original version came out in 1964. Wilson Pickett, which is the version that we hear in this episode, recorded the most successful version and released a cover of the song on his 1966 album, The Wicked Pickett. This version actually explicitly mentions Solomon Burke in the opening section. It made it to number 29 on pop and number 19 on R&B in early 1967.
That is so cool.
The song is also in My Beloved Blues Brothers. It is sung by John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd as the Blues Brothers. It was included on the soundtrack album, and in 1989 it was re-released as a single in the UK, backed by Think, but failed to chart.
That's so interesting. Because, yeah, I think a lot of people probably know it from Blues Brothers before they know it from Wilson Pickett.
Yeah, I definitely knew Blues Brothers before I knew the Wilson Pickett version. But luckily now, I know the one that I'm meant to know.
And this will not be the last time that we talk about Wilson Pickett this year.
And then we cut to...
We're back in the townhouse, and Avery and Murphy are coming in. Avery yells out the door, "Are you sure you don't want to come in for some coffee?" To which we hear the speeding tires of, assuming, Bob's car, driving him and his father the hell away from the brown woman. To which mm-hmm. Avery yells, "That's right, run away, loser, loser!" It's...
I want to yell that loser, loser way more in my life.
It's so great the way that she yells at her. Murphy sits on the couch. Avery comes in, and I love it. She puts her hat on the decorative bust that's usually yeah. on the bookcase, yeah. Which I think usually has like a baseball or like a football hat on.
Yep.
When I say football hat, I know I don't mean like one that the players wear. I meant like it had a football.
Not a helmet.
Not a helmet. I was like, made me sound like Avery.
It's a ball cap. It's a ball cap. It usually has a cap on.
Murphy looks kind of just tired and devastated, and Avery looks delighted. And to Murphy, she goes, "I wonder if he'll call." To which Murphy says, "Oh God, what a wonderful evening. I'll be sure to put this in my memoirs under the chapter Great Men Who've Run Screaming Out of My Life." To which they both then just break up into hysterics.
I will say it to the end of my days, Colleen Dewhurst's laugh is my joy. It is... It just escapes from her. She can't hold it in, and it's so raspy, and it's so great. I love it.
It's great because it just shows how as like devastating emotionally as they're going to talk about, like the idea of another man is intimidated, right, by mm-hmm. by her competitiveness. She bonded with her mother over that, but that they can mm-hmm. laugh at it, right? That like this is yeah. them coming together and having a bonding mother-daughter moment that they haven't been able yeah. to have throughout their life. It's such a great little thing that you get by just having them both laugh at how ridiculous mm-hmm. it is. Avery sits down and does something very sweet where she, because Murphy has taken off these big boots, because you can imagine mm-hmm. it must be very painful. And what's lovely is that Avery sits down and takes her daughter's feet and puts it on her lap and starts to rub them.
Mm-hmm. It's such a tender moment of physical affection. And I think, you know, there's a lot to be said about not withholding affection from your child throughout their life. But I do think that because clearly affection was withheld in this way, in this mother-daughter dynamic, it means so much more in this moment because it's so casual and natural, and it's clearly not their normal dynamic. But it's such a, like, for a pair that clearly did not have a traditional mother-daughter relationship as people understand it, as mm-hmm. as is normally portrayed, which I think is probably perhaps more normal than a lot of people estimate. Mm-hmm. Seeing her have this very natural, casual, almost unintended physical affection, it's so meaningful to witness that because they both just settle into it. And I think it speaks to me and my lived experience in less than conventional female dynamics in my own family. That particularly touched me.
Yeah, it's very touching. And I almost like to think that maybe these are the kind of interactions they had before Murphy can remember. Mm-hmm. And then they just were so at odds with each other that they grew apart and it got awkward and it became more sort of this traditional, well, not traditional, this sort of so-called white Philadelphia upper crust.
Yep. Yeah, just this idea of like, I love the representation that like just because someone is not particularly effusive or demonstrative doesn't mean that they don't, having a maternal side can manifest in multiple ways.
Absolutely.
And that Avery, and we see with Murphy as well, can be maternal without being a cliche.
Oh, that's lovely. Absolutely. Murphy muses why they can't both take the easy route. Mm-hmm. To which Avery says, because it's boring and dishonest and uncomfortable, like wearing a pair of shoes that pinch your feet.
Oh, it's such a good line.
And then Murphy says, yeah, but sometimes I wish I were a different kind of person. And that line really spoke to me.
Yep.
And it was great to hear Murphy Brown say that, mm-hmm. because she is a character who is betrayed in a way, who is always confident about who she is, and in a way that is aspirational for many women at the time, and hopefully still today, through a modern context in its own way. And to know that she feels something that I think that many women, including myself, sometimes feel, particularly those who maybe might be in some way out of the norm from the so-called norm of society mm-hmm. in any way, this line really spoke to me. And it's, I think, so wonderful and so vulnerable to have Murphy Brown, of all yeah. characters, to say that. As confident as she is, as headstrong as she is, as take no prisoners as she is, that it can still hurt sometimes and that she might think, well, maybe I wish I was someone else.
I completely agree because I felt the exact same way at that moment. The word I was coming up with as well was this idea of this, I think, honestly, kind of in a similar way to us saying, you know, that first moment that you see your parents as people, the first time you see someone that you find aspirational and realize that they don't see themselves as always as idealistic as you do, you know, that they are also flawed. And, you know, for somebody who I find really inspiring because she didn't take the easy way there, it makes complete sense that they would have moments of vulnerability of being like, I'd actually rather it be a little easier sometimes. That one of the reasons that we love this show so much, and I think I can speak for both of us, is that she is a character with flaws who would probably wish that she had fewer.
Yeah.
You know, and I love I love actually seeing that. And I love seeing it in this way that is, as opposed to what Avery says, which is, you know, doing it the other way would be dishonest and easy, is this is such a sincere moment. This is, I truly believe this is a one of the few times where Murphy would honestly admit that desire and that pain. It's not thrown away in some other scene that doesn't feel as genuine. This is the moment where I do believe that she would voice that, and I believe she doesn't voice it easily.
And I think for a character in a way that also resonates today, this idea of she's bucking against a system, right? Mm-hmm. Or a society, or pop culture norms, or, you know, things that she's told she's not supposed to be. And the fact that she has a vulnerable moment where society pushes back and mm-hmm. makes her feel like, well, maybe I just need to not be myself to be accepted and to receive love, mm-hmm. is particularly in today when we have, you know, Instagram and any sort of social media that gives off an image that is maybe not real.
Yeah, the curated, right? Cultivated life.
Exactly. That makes you feel like, well, I am a lesser person perhaps because I'm feeling the crush of society making me feel like I need to change who I am. And to see that a human thing, and that everyone has vulnerabilities, even someone like someone as tough as Murphy Brown, mm-hmm. I think some people will beat themselves up to go, oh, well, I'm caving, like I'm mm-hmm. better than this, like this is bad, as well, as opposed to say, you know what, I'm being vulnerable right now and it's okay.
I think it's very easy to hold up people who took the trailblazing path, who are very strong and confident, and hold them up as the ideal. And I think there's also something very beautiful about it being okay to want a simpler life sometimes. Murphy can both love the life she has. There's a great line coming from Avery later in this episode at the end of the scene. But she can love her life and know that she has a good life. And also, it's okay to want something simpler sometimes. It's okay to want to be a career woman as much as it's okay to want to stay at home and be a mother. It's okay to every once in a while resent the fact that your life isn't as simple or as easy as it could have been because of the choices that you've made.
Yeah. Like, I think I've said this before in the podcast, but very early on was that when I was a kid, feminism taught me, you know, from my kid point of view, because I didn't get the nuance of adulthood, that I didn't need a man. What I learned when I got older was that maybe I might want one.
Yeah.
Or a partner at all, because mm-hmm. everybody is lonely. And mm-hmm. it's so fascinating to me watching this and then watching the behind the scenes, that the goal that Diane had for this episode when they started to break story and come up with ideas was she wanted Murphy and her mother to grapple with loneliness.
Yep.
And this scene shows you that in so many ways.
Yeah. It's a great idea of, like, they knew where they wanted it to go. Now, how do they get there?
Yeah.
And we've finally gotten there.
Murphy asks her mother if she ever thinks that she'd be alone forever.
Ugh.
That line. Particularly coming after Jerry, right?
Yep.
Avery admits many times, you know, that she and Murphy's father would have this ritual on Sunday afternoons where they would make a fire and they would sit by it and read. And she thinks of making a fire, but now there's no one to sit in front of it with. Mm. And then Murphy says something that I think she's wrong about. She says that at least her mother can say that once that she was really in love, like really in love. But Murphy doesn't think that that happens for everybody. You know, we've said this in the last episode, so I don't think we have to belabor it. But, you know, Murphy has been in love. She has many soulmates mm-hmm. and many loves, platonic mm-hmm. and, you know, romantic. They're just shorter. But she has had it.
We're also speaking in removed hindsight. So it can make sense that when you're in the middle of it, like she is, she's assuming that she hasn't found it yet.
And to just put in a little joke that I wrote, short love often with short men. I'll be here all week.
Hey.
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 And Avery gives her this beautiful speech about how she never read fairy tales to Murphy, that the knight in shining armor doesn't always show up. We have to make our own way. Mm-hmm. That line gets me every time.
I think there's something so... What I like about, like, is such a small word for this, but about Colleen's performance as Avery in this moment is that this scene, sometimes you have characters that show a sudden vulnerability or something like that, and it feels, while I believe the actor, it seems out of left field for the character. Mm-hmm. And what I love about Colleen's ability, her skill in playing Avery, is that it's not out of left field for this vulnerability, partially because she's not suddenly overly demonstrative in her vulnerability and in her thoughts. It's very thoughtful vulnerability. It's very measured. Mm-hmm. It's soft and gentle, but it's not suddenly effusive. You know, it's so artfully done, and it means that much more because it's not overdone. It's almost like a gentle sliding door of a glimpse inside of her, and then she just slides it back shut again. It just happens and it goes back, and it's not a sudden catharsis. It's so honest and true to life. We rarely have these big dramatic moments of sharing, but we do have these moments where we get a glimpse through the veil to the person inside. And I do believe that this is what Avery looks like when she's vulnerable.
Yeah, no, and her vulnerability is quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. So Avery decides that they've had quite a day and they must get their beauty sleep.
Indeed.
After all, she has a plane to catch in the morning, and Murphy is so disappointed, like a little child, that her mother is leaving. Like, can't she just stay one more day? Avery says that she's all of a sudden feeling much better. That's what's also sort of beautiful, right? Like, you think that she already sort of feels that way after mm-hmm. the scene, but I think a lot of it also is talking with her daughter that they have something in common. Yeah. And not only does she feel better that she can still shake things up, she's sure that we're not compatible as roommates. You don't seem to be able to keep up with me.
Incredible. Incredible line.
It's amazing. But it also feels like she's kind of just also putting on a show for her daughter in a way, to be like, because of the fact that she mm-hmm. goes, "My daughter, you have your own life, and it's a very good one."
Oh, I love that line.
It's beautiful because she's pretty much saying, I need to let you live your life just like I need to live my own. Mm-hmm. But it also has a sense of pride, mm-hmm. right? Like, I am so proud of the woman that you have become, and you need to live that wonderful life.
And there's this air of, because Murphy is in her own way pleading for her to stay. Like, this idea of, like, this mother, this version of my mother, stay for a little longer. Like, can I just have a little longer with this? With this knowledge that, like, they're going to go back to normal and they're going to be what they are, but can we, like, extend this moment a little longer? And I love this idea of Avery being like, you don't need me as much as you think you do. Like, this, like, you have a good life, you have your own life, it's a very good one, you don't mm-hmm. need this. And then the little concession at the end.
Yeah. She goes, well, let's get our beauty sleep. And she does this thing where she puts her hand behind, like, to grab her daughter's hand. Mm-hmm. It's very sweet. Like, it's almost like something they did as a child when she was like a little toddler or something. But then she has sort of that last thought of, although it is a nice night for a fire.
Oh, yes, it is.
And Murphy puts her arm around her mother and they go towards the fireplace and she goes, you're on. And what's also beautiful about this is that they don't need a romantic partner to sit in front of a fire with.
I was literally about to say that idea of that there can be someone sitting with you at the fire. It doesn't have to be a copy paste. It doesn't have to be just the metaphor of sitting next to the fire with someone. It could be so many loves of your life.
Yeah. And then I think in a way, even though Diane left, it fits into the course of the series and then into the revival of this idea that Murphy doesn't end up with a man. The love of her life is her son.
Yes, he is.
And that's okay. And I don't want this to feel like I'm saying, oh, well, you must have a child to not be lonely and blah, 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 blah. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying mm-hmm. that in the trajectory of Murphy's life, right? Because the fact that Diane said she wanted it to be about the two of them grappling with loneliness, not grappling with not having a man in their life, because that is two separate things. Yeah. Having someone to sit by a fire with can just be someone that you care about and whose company you enjoy. Call your moms, everyone.
Call your loved ones. If you don't have a mom figure, call your loved ones.
And of course, Murphy Brown dominated guest actor in a comedy category.
I mean, when you got it, you flaunt it.
Yeah. Not only did Jay win for the previous episode as Jerry Gold, Colleen Dewhurst won Best Guest Actress in a Comedy Series, although she did receive it after she passed away.
What an actual legend.
It's a wonderful performance.
She's incredible. Ah, so well-deserved.
Candace Bergen plays Murphy Brown, but the tough-talking journalist actually lives here, inside the imagination of this woman, Diane English, the co-executive producer who dreamed Murphy up in the first place, and still decides her destiny every Monday night. It is now 10 a.m. Monday on the week they have to film. The clock has started to tick.
To me, Monday morning is the worst thing, because it's when you really lay yourself out to be so vulnerable.
Everyone, writers, actors, technical people, even a CBS representative keeping an eye out for the censors, gathers around the table for the first reading of the script.
Monday, when you first hear it aloud and it's going to be judged silently or, you know, by the number of laughs.
So just a brief description of this Primetime Live. Diane Sawyer spent the week with the Murphy Brown crew, and starting from literally the idea, film crew in the writer's room, you know, for those who maybe haven't listened to some of our earlier episodes, the writers would come back to work first. They would break story in a room together, sort of talk about the trajectory of the episodes of the season, perhaps if there's sort of arc topics they want to talk about, and then break down the individual episodes, come up with ideas, and then separately go off and write the episodes. Then throughout the week, they will all collectively work on the episode together. Probably about through like Wednesday or so, the cast will be getting new scripts until the script is locked. Although it doesn't mean that, as we've talked about on set, the day that they're filming, that a writer might not walk up to someone and say this line instead.
So I find it very savvy business. I'm going to assume that the Murphy Brown team, and you know, Murphy Brown team, friends of the pod, please let us know if we are incorrect about this, if you know, but it seems intentional that the behind the scenes following the creation of an episode is on a Diane English written episode.
Oh, yes.
Because we are specifically following the vehicle as helmed by Diane English, created, the, you know, produced by it. Like, it would be a very different kind of behind the scenes narrative if we were watching a different writing team working on the episode and seeing the writer's room that way. It's clearly like the special is showing how Diane creates and leads this. If it was a different episode written by different writers, you know, as the lead writers, it would be a very different kind of singular narrative of how the episode is crafted. It's very smart from a branding of Murphy Brown as created by Diane English avenue to have this be a Diane English episode.
Yeah, and as the showrunner,
because they're like, Diane goes away and writes the episode. And I was like, well, not every time. And I was like, oh, that's so intentional, though, because it's brilliant. Because, you know, this is the woman who ends up in print ads about her. Like, you, Diane English is as much, you know, a part of the success of the Murphy Brown narrative as the show is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think also they knew if it was an Avery episode, it would probably be a surefire episode. It would be an interesting episode to follow. Yes, I think it's very deliberate, the episode that they chose.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is also really interesting is not only seeing the week and, you know, how things change, but also, like, it was the first time that I learned what a mark was, right? Like, they show the marks on the stage. They show the behind the scenes of getting in the elevator and what it looks like. We alluded to the fact that Eldon was in this episode, and he has, like, one line, as far as we know, right? Mm-hmm. But they show Robert Pastorelli practicing his line, like, backstage, like, as if he's talking to Candace.
Yeah. Because it's the start of this little special, is him practicing this line. And for a second, I was like, oh, this must be footage from a different episode because he's not in this one. And I went, oh, wait. As they're going, I'm like, oh, no, this is about, he got cut from this episode.
Yeah, his line is, excuse me, I was cleaning out your kitchen drawers. I'm prepping to prime them. Why does a woman with the initials MB have a whole set of flatware that says TWA?
Honestly, such a vibe. I love that line. My family had a whole set of juice glasses
from
Northwest Airlines for years.
Also interesting, which I think people may not realize, that even though Diane goes off and writes the episode, you see her pitching the sort of bones of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to grapple with loneliness. Avery's mother is going to show up unexpectedly, and she's going to go out for 2 hours and come back. She's found a man, right? You know, they have all that set.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see them talk about, well, the date could be at Phil's or it could be something unique. And then all the writers sort of throw out their ideas. I think some of them are what? Deep sea fishing was
bowling.
One of them. Bowling, an accountant's club.
But I do feel like the bowling suggestion is what leads to pool.
Probably, yeah. And also pitching like, you know, what is this guy's job? Oh, he's an accountant. He's a senator, right? And then all these, you know, different suggestions that end up.
Yeah, they say congressman, senator. Yeah. Clearly, like all these roles that he eventually does play.
I also think it's interesting they have a top 40 book of songs. Did you notice that?
Well, I
also the cassette player that Diane uses, the purple one. I had that one in pink.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, my God, my cassette player. Not that I've seen this a million times, but it's so fascinating to see sort of the process. And I think the episode is really good about sort of, you know, delineating that, right? Like it shows you the week. It shows you, you know, what everyone's doing. There's also a cut line when Jim is yelling at Murphy where she says, getting old, Jim, which is not in it. But there's like one of the days I think they're doing camera rehearsals where she says, getting old, Jim. And then Charles Kimbrough just starts dancing.
Oh, my God. Everyone's just laughing.
Making music for him, like on the the water cooler. It's so great.
Charlie! And
with his little like
curly
hair.
Do this thing, which we won't go into because we have said the origin of the casting of these characters a million times. But of course, Primetime Live has to like, you know, say like, this is how this person was cast. And Diane English fought for Candace Bergen. Like they do the whole thing for every character, basically. But when they're talking about Faith Ward being cast as Corky, she goes, you know, I was nervous because I didn't want to be a bimbo again. And Charlie's just in the background. He's like, I didn't want to be a bimbo either.
Yeah,
like,
they all
the amount
That's
of like
great.
Real Charlie little nuggets that we get within that, and then his dancing. You're just like, ah, Charlie in his glasses.
Yeah, and then they talk about the different lines in the scene with Avery. The line about, it's better than sitting in that big house in Philadelphia watching Fatal Attraction over and over again. And you see the lines and you see that like it has the same rhythm, right? The joke has the same rhythm, but it's just different. It's, you know, it ends with cutting daddy out of the family pictures, playing gin rummy with the gardener, which made me laugh because, of course, we find out later is that she has a huge affair with the gardener.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
I feel like maybe that idea came out of that.
Maybe.
Like they just saved that memory.
But it's funny because even though they have like a very similar rhythm, when you hear the final joke, you're like, oh, yeah, well, that's the winner. That's the better joke.
And I also like it because it's the kind of the resentful menace of cutting daddy out of the family pictures. But it's a slightly more of a thinker joke because you have to know the Fatal Attraction reference and then make the, like, it's a smarter joke because it's a reference that you have to know to then connect to. And that's why it's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love all the three different lines. I love that we see it and we get to hear it read. So you get that rhythm. I love that we get to see Barnett on set doing his thing, talking about how he got to learn, you know, the neuroses of Frank. And Diane claims that Joe's claimed he's going to stop telling them things about his personal life because they're going to keep getting written into the episodes on all of his neuroses. Barnett talks about how, you know, he didn't realize until he met Candace Bergen that she walks like Groucho. Candace's natural walk is comedic, so therefore now Murphy's walk is comedic. So all those elements of the actual actors, we talk about how Jim is so different than Charlie. And that's during the Barnett section is where I had to stop and rewind a couple times to look at the fact that in the bullpen rehearsal, Candace is wearing her casual outfit from the townhouse.
Yeah.
But the flats are different. The whole shoe conversation is fascinating to me. I'm like, so is this just a different pair of Candace's shoes, or did they make her change her shoes to have less nice shoes for when she's being casual and not caring?
Good point, right? Yeah.
My first thought was like, are they rehearsing before she films that next episode, that next scene? Or nope, Candace is just, they just use Candace's outfit.
Yeah.
They just straight up use her outfit.
Yeah. Oh, and we see some of the people that we've interviewed on the show in the very small writer's room.
Yeah. I was like, look at them. Look at my friends. Look at my buddies. They're so little.
They're so young and little. And, you know, watching this as a kid, I always thought that Diane was so glamorous. And,
oh my God,
you know,
her hair
just
is
taking,
incredible.
Oh, I always, oh God, did I want, like, with my big.
She, like, runs her hand through her hair at one point. It just flops back down to the perfect shiny bob. I'm obsessed with it.
I have very, very thick Jewish hair. And that was always, like, my dream to be able to just, like, gloss it down like that and not have it be huge and big. It was just sort of fantastic. And it's just great to see professionals at work, right? Like, just to see, like, professionals and how the show is run. And it's hard to describe, right? Because the people haven't seen it yet, or hopefully you will have seen it for people who are on our Patreon, or again, we'll have clips on the social media. But it's really a great, fascinating behind the scenes on not just Murphy Brown, but on like how a sitcom in the 90s is made. And I don't think I've ever seen anything like it.
I really appreciate that the part of the read through that they spotlight is Faith reading that great line from the first scene.
Yeah, and everyone
about
is
the coffee being gone.
Laughing so hard
it's
at her.
I love it. You just see, like, that's one of my favorite things about a first table read is everyone discovering moments either themselves as they're reading it or discover or enjoying each other because they, you know, they have to play it straight once you're in filming. So this is one of the first times where you get to really just enjoy each other's performances and not worry about whether you're in scene or not because you're just reading the lines for in performance for the writers, but what you're doing when it's not your line is not worrisome. So it's just fun to watch them all just openly admiring her insane read of this line.
And Candace talks about that, right? That is not for them. That's for the writers.
Yep.
To hear it out loud, see what's working so they can go back in the room and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And as we've mentioned before, each rewrite gets a different color so that you know which draft you're on. And a lot of times it gets cut for time or just, you know, things aren't working. But also they talk about that the script gets like set Wednesday at like, what was it? They were there until like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
People don't realize, right? Like so many of the writers talked about they, you know, didn't see their kids, right? If you're writing until 3 a.m. And then you have to be at work again in the morning, that's, you know, that's a lot of work.
And one final thing I just love is they're talking, you see them on, you know, their final rehearsals on Friday morning. They're all prepping. They're backstage. They're running a line. They're doing all these things. And you just get this shot of Bobby Passarelli just standing backstage, like running a line to himself. And then it's just him talking to the camera crew saying, you see how calm I am inside? Kuwait. Which honestly, I'm going to take that. Robert Passarelli, your spirit just gave me one of my favorite lines to describe inner turmoil for the rest of my life.
It's also great because you see, you know, the gang piling into the elevator and they're still running lines, right?
Yeah, which is so real. It's, yeah.
Joe particularly is like, ah, nope, time to go. Yeah. Sorry. It is what
Let's
it
go.
Is.
Let's film it. Let's see. It's so good.
Obviously, we love talking about Colleen Dewhurst. And even though she did pass away shortly after this episode, we do have one more episode to pay tribute to her and talk more about her. And we have some great things to talk about then. So definitely join us for season 4. We'll continue the Avery Brown love. We would love to hear your thoughts on this episode on the podcast. You can email us at murphybrownpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. We hope you love this episode as much as we did. I was very happy to discover that I still believe this is the Avery Brown episode.
Absolutely.
And we're just so happy to be here covering some of these incredible, I think very well-earned episodes of season 3. Thank you for listening, friends.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please show us your support by
liking,
subscribing,
and interacting with us on social media.
Our handle everywhere is
at Murphy Brown Pod.
You can also email us at
murphybrownpod@gmail.com
or visit our website at
murphybrownpod.com.
Share us with your friends.
Give us a 5-star rating
wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by checking out our Patreon.
You can donate once
or be a recurring subscriber
and access exclusive deep dives on Murphy Brown and other related topics,
as well as bonus content we had to cut for time.
100% of what you donate goes toward creating this podcast.
So any way you are able to support, we deeply appreciate.
And we'll see you next time
for another edition of FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast.
You know, what happens out here on a Friday night is a lot more complicated than it looks. And remember, most of it's done before a live studio audience. It's complicated because the actors have to move in front of 4 separate cameras, and each of the cameras is rolling at the same time. That's why it takes a lot of rehearsal. By the way, there's not a single object on any one of these sets that is here by accident. Everyone designed for authenticity. But as we were saying, the actors have to move the same way each time, or one of the cameras will cut off their heads or lose them altogether. That's why on some of the sets you can see tape on the floor, and the tape shows the members of the cast exactly where they're supposed to land. It's distracting enough that some of the actors use the objects in the room as improvised cue cards so they can remember their lines. And this week there's another adventure, another obstacle. Candace Bergen, who plays a woman who is supposed to hustle news and hustle stories, has to be able to show on camera that she can do a little hustling of a different kind.